Hi, my name is Steve.
My name is Alana? Did I do it right?
You did it. Well done.
Yay!
Alana, why don't you introduce yourself to the people?
I'm a video game writer at Sony Santa Monica Studio, but also a content creator. I do YouTube and Twitch largely for charity. I have a podcast called Play, Watch, Listen, which is for people in the games industry talking about video games. And I don't know, Steve, a bunch of other stuff, I guess.
Well, luckily for you, that's exactly what we're here to find out. So we are going to start, as James Lipson would say, at the beginning. Where did you grow up?
I was born in a city in Australia called Cairns, which most people probably visit to go to the Great Barrier Reef. So that means that a big chunk of my childhood was spent in the Great Barrier Reef, which, wow, am I thankful for, considering the amount of people who will never get to see it, and definitely not the way that it looked when I was a kid. Like, my mom worked for this hotel, so my sister and I would get these free, weekend passes to go just swim with fish. It's the most Australian thing in the world. But that's also the most interesting thing about Cairns. It's what we in Australia would call a shithole. It's not a very good city. Really hot. It's basically like the Florida of Australia. And then when I was 12, I moved to Brisbane, which I think is still our third largest city. Similar vibes, still very Florida.
What do you remember about Cairns?
Aside from the Great Barrier Reef, I feel like a lot of my memories of Cairns are probably tied to like really simple stuff, like learning to ride a bike. Like, I remember my dad teaching me to ride a bike, and I remember the day that I was riding the bike by myself. He didn't tell me, he just let go. And then I was like ages away, and from down the street, he was like, "You're doing it!" And I was like, "Oh my God!" So I remember a lot of stuff like that. What else do I remember about Cairns? Definitely my dog, who was a Rottweiler. Her name was Bella. She died when she was 14, which for a Rottweiler is quite old. Beautiful dog, and I used to just play with her all the time. But if you read through any of my diaries from when I was growing up in Cairns, my life was video games and my dog. So I would always just talk about the games I was playing and that Rottweiler. So that's like a lot of those memories. But I also did have like a pretty rough childhood because my dad was suffering from some pretty significant mental health problems. He has schizophrenia. So I won't get into the extremes of that, but it does mean that, you know, I spent a chunk of my childhood being scared. And I think that that has shaped me pretty significantly. As an adult, I think it's made me extra empathetic. The biggest problem that I've had from that, I think, and for the record, Dad is now fully medicated. He's a saint. I absolutely love him to bits. But I have this terrible habit, specifically with men, kind of letting them get away with things and never treating them like things are their fault, which is probably coming from when I was a kid trying to defend my dad. And I had like a therapist say that to me. They were like, "Oh yeah, that's happened because you're protecting your dad still." And I was like, "Shit, you're right." So that's definitely an outset of that, and was a significant part of my childhood that I don't tend to talk about a lot, mostly out of respect for dad, because I don't want to do that. But that's, I feel like my childhood was otherwise like pretty happy, a lot of Nintendo 64, playing with that dog, played a lot of soccer. And that Great Barrier Reef is wonderful.
Are there things about Australia that you miss to this day?
It's the food, Steve. Just, and the coffee. I'm going home really soon and I'm really excited. In Australia, when you quarantine, you have to spend the first 2 weeks in a hotel. You don't even know where they're taking you to. It's just a hotel. There's a guard. You can't leave. But I've already figured out a way to get an Australian friend to bring me sausage rolls and coffee. That's my MO. I mean, I miss my family all the time. My family's very important to me. I'm really excited to get to go home because my sister's pregnant. So I'm going to be an aunt for the first time.
Nice.
I keep telling her that she has to wait until I get there because I just want to see her pregnant. Even if it's like 2 days, please just wait. But yeah, it's food. I miss a lot of food. I miss the safety of Australia too. Obviously, when I moved to the US, I moved to San Francisco and I now live in LA. But the streets around here just don't, in these two cities, there are a lot of places that feel fine. I feel like probably where you are doesn't even feel as shady as parts of LA can feel. But yeah, you can walk around Australia at midnight as a woman alone and never be worried. And I miss the constant sense of security for sure.
Wow, that sounds like a great place to be at nighttime and enjoy the nightlife. You touched on it briefly, but let's go into it a little bit deeper. Who is your mother?
My mom, who is she? She's me, but like maybe more sassy. So my mom's name is Susan. We played through the entirety of Until Dawn on my YouTube channel, which is the only game I've ever played through start to finish. And it was so much fun. So now sometimes people on the internet refer to her as Mamazard, which I like a lot. She is an accountant, has been for a while. And yeah, where I'm really bad at numbers, she's actually, I feel like my mom's kind of good at everything. Like she could just do all of it. During quarantine, when I had to be alone, obviously very different in Australia, I was like, I'm going to stop playing guitar. So she just bought a guitar so that we could play together, like over video calls. Yeah, she's wonderful, awesome sense of humor. I feel like I treat my mom more like a friend than a mother. But maybe sometimes I feel like I'm her mother because she'll call me and be like, how do I open a PDF? She just like doesn't know tech at all. I had to leave my Xbox One Kinect in Australia when I left because my parents only knew how to use the TV via Kinect. So aww. Yeah, my mom's awesome and I miss her every day.
Who is your father?
My dad. His name is Vince. He is also wonderful, very, very sensitive human. Every time that I go to the airport, he's sobbing, crying, which, you know, mom cries, but dad's like very emotional tears. He's a building manager. So I feel like I get the impression, and I've not seen it in him, but I think he's probably pretty strict work-wise. I think as a building manager, anyone like leaves a cardboard box out, I think my dad's probably the type of dude who's like, it's not perfect. What are the resident? What if somebody trips? Like, I think he's very like type A on top of the building, but I think he hides it from me pretty well. So he's like very dedicated to his work and always has been, likes doing things perfectly. He, most of his career was basically worked in like various different types of construction. So just built a lot of shit. And it's a fun thing is like anytime that I need anything built, like anything that I could dream of, if I even mention it, dad's like, wait till I get to America and I'll build it for you. He's like, I'll build you a bookcase, it'll be great. And it's like the most dad stuff, but it's super fun. But he's also a massive kid. So when my mom visited America last, we went to Yosemite. And then when my dad visits, we go to Disney World and Universal. And he loves roller coasters. He loves arcades. He's just a giant child. When mom is more like, I want to go wine tasting. Let's go to Napa Valley. So they're really different people. And it's like they're divorced ages ago. It's very hard to even imagine them ever being together because they're so different. But yeah, it's like my dad's a big kid. He's a lot of fun. Loves football. Loves building stuff. A pretty like basic Aussie dad, except that he's very emotional and okay with it. He's fine with being a big softy. Where mom is like fashionable and creative and... I mean, they're both just very sweet. I lucked out with my parents. They're so supportive of everything I do, even though they have no fucking concept of what it actually is.
How was it growing up under their influence?
Well, like I said, some parts of that were really rough. Schizophrenia means that you wouldn't really necessarily know the days that something was going to be bad because it just showed up. And I'm sure it's different for different people. So that was... you know, some definitely just rough stuff there. Again, I don't want to talk about it. Not out of fear of talking about it myself, just to protect my family, really. Like, they haven't signed up for this online bullshit I have going on. So there were, you know, days where I just remember crying and, like, helping my sister when things were aggressive or whatever. But outside of those things, because there were also times when my dad was my dad and wasn't this other person that he has a separate name for. Really creative, I think. I feel like my parents were, like, very... open to whatever I wanted to try and to encouraging me to try different things like board games, like art. They were just very, anything I showed any interest in, not in a like prize parent way where they do the whole like, make sure you do this, we want you to achieve. They were just like, if you have interest in it, let's go see what you think of it. So I did like triathlons as a kid. I did a lot of painting, a lot of art all the time. I was writing books from like the age of 6 that my dad would help me basically proofread. And one thing that I also think really significantly shaped me in terms of how much I share is that my dad, for my sister and I, when we were kids, wrote us these kids' books. It was about a bee called Ruzzy Bee that was pollinating all the flowers. And he wrote all these songs that went with it that I could still sing. It's like buzz, 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 buzz. And I could like go through the whole songs, but he never published them. It was just for my sister and I. So he would write full kid stories, full music, like had a pianist actually write the music. He got art made just for my sister and I. And I think that shaped me as a writer, and that now, even if I write a book, I don't ever feel the need to publish it. I'm like, I can share this with whoever I think will get something from it. I don't need to share it with the world. And I know that's a thing that most people are like, why would you not publish the thing you wrote? I'm like, I just don't care. I think that comes from dad, which is a very fun thing. He was also always really autistic, which I always need to qualify. I'm saying artistic. The way Australians pronounce autistic is the same as the way Americans pronounce autistic. People catch me up on that one a lot. But outside of that, played a lot of video games. And my parents were always really cool with me playing video games. And that was awesome. They like used it as a reward for if I finished homework, I got to play the N64. So I feel like growing up under their influence, certainly in the first few years before my parents got divorced, and then my dad actually like figured out what was wrong with him and addressed it, very dramatic in a lot of ways. But I've always felt loved and I've always felt very supported. And I know a lot of people who don't have those relationships with their parents where I can talk to them on the phone for like 2 hours and it's just like talking to a friend. So I feel very lucky to have the parents that I have for sure.
Do you feel like one of those life lessons that they taught you back then still stands out today?
I think the biggest one is probably my dad's parents are Mormon, like quite strictly Mormon. So whenever they were around, my sister and I had to pretend to be Mormon just so that it wouldn't cause this conflict. Like we'd have to wear certain things. We couldn't say crap. And my dad was also quite scared of his dad, I think. So that there was a layer there. But my parents made the decision to make sure that we didn't get baptized until we decided what religion we wanted. So they took us to a Catholic school, I guess, because it was the best school in the area, not because of any religious reason. But that, and that at the time was kind of awful that I wasn't baptized because some of the teachers would treat me like I was dirty. I remember one particular teacher, Mrs. Maloney, literally said I was filthy and that I shouldn't sit in the same section in the church as the kids who were baptized. And that was like awful as a kid. But now I think that that choice, especially like going to a Catholic school and being one of the only kids who wasn't baptized, really imparted on me that I don't have to be the same as everyone else and that I should make my own decisions. And I feel like that stuck with me forever. One other very cool thing that I think that they did was if they tickled us and we said no, they would stop. So the intent there was to impart on two young girls, being my sister and I, that we can say no, that we have agency over our own bodies and that it is our choice and that we should feel like correct to say no to things that we don't want. So those two things I feel like definitely significantly impacted me in ways that I like seem super woke. It's like, damn parents. And it's like this, you know, parents being old, there's always like some ways in which like my dad will say something that I'm like, for fuck's sake. But he also is writing a book right now that's a horror, and just of his own volition, the protagonist is an Aboriginal girl. Just like my dad doesn't go on Twitter. He doesn't know that like that's woke. Like he was just like, yeah, of course it's an Aboriginal girl. That makes the most sense. And it's like, that's damn, dude, that rules. It's awesome. But yeah, I feel like they really like with both my sister and I just imparted that we should do the things that we want to do and chase the things we want to chase. Again, in a way that I feel really lucky for. I know a lot of people, especially in the US, whose parents aren't quite like that.
I really hope that there's a singing bee in the middle of that book. I don't know why, but I really want that to be a thing.
We could probably make that happen, actually. We'd get the Ruzzy Bee universe crossover.
You mentioned that you had your mom in some of your video content. What was that like getting to film with a parent and sort of having them be not only a part of your life, but in your content as well?
I've done one video with Dad, where I had him try VR for the first time. My sister was also in one episode of that Until Dawn series. I just find it fun, I think. I'm very careful with my family in that I make sure that all of them have private profiles on everything because of a stalker in Australia. So that I'm very careful with them about like make sure that there's no way that anyone can find out where you are, because this guy literally threatened my mom, like was like, well, Alana's not here, so I'll take her mom out and then she'll have to come home, which is a whole thing that is currently being dealt with, but it's been happening for like 2 years. So yeah, I'm very careful with them about that in protecting their privacy and making sure that they don't get any of the negative side effects of my career, basically. And they're all fine with it. But generally, I feel like my whole family is pretty charismatic, so having them on content is just really fun. Like, I've been trying to think of something that I could maybe do with my sister because she's pregnant when I go home. Like, maybe do some kind of, like, maybe we do, like, a time capsule. Like, I make a video where I ask her a bunch of questions while she's still pregnant about her kid, and then we show it to them in 5 years or something like that. But I have this podcast that I have been doing on and off. It's called Red Lips Orange Car, where I basically just have two guests pick a story from the internet about something that is just wild and then present it on the show anonymously. And I had my mom and my aunt do one of those episodes. So it was me, my mom, and my aunt. And it was like my favorite episode of the whole show, like just drinking wine with them, talking about like just these stories that happened when they were kids that I'd never heard before. So I think it's really fun, but I am, like I said, always really conscious of their security and privacy and making sure that nothing bad happens to them as a result of my job, I suppose. If my mom starts getting shit when the next God of War game comes out because there's something someone doesn't like in it, I quit. I'd be so done.
Well, hopefully the internet won't do that.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see. So let's go back to baby Alana. So growing up, you know, what were you interested in as a child?
I feel like we covered it, Steve. It was video games and dogs.
Like, that's it, just video games and dogs. Was it a particular
pretty
dog?
Pretty specific.
Any dog?
I like big dogs, so I was into that Rottweiler a whole lot. I really liked horses. I was a bit of a horse girl. I'm trying to think of other things. Like, I've always been really interested in space. So even when I was a kid, you know, I had stars in my room and planets and all that stuff. I was always really, really into space. And it's still my number one life goal is to go to space in some capacity, which I know is probably not feasible, but we'll try. I just have to get like $29 billion together or something. I should probably stop raising money for charity.
Start a GoFund right now.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely. I was really shy when I was a kid. And I only stopped being shy, even though I feel like I still have sort of a unique brand of shyness, when I was like maybe 15 or so. It took a pretty long time before I even really spoke to anyone. But I loved just being outdoors, loved the beach, still do. A lot of that stuff hasn't changed that much. But yeah, I mean, from the age of 3, I was all about video games and writing. And those are the two things that I've always stuck to throughout my life. I feel like I've been pretty consistent.
What were your academic interests as a child?
Writing as well. I used to, you know, write books in my spare time, but I was also all through school. And I always want to post this. I just have to figure out the way that I would phrase it. I was, I think, like 5 years in a row in the top 0.5% of the country for literary skills. And I always want to do, like, I'll figure it out one day, like a side by side of like a comment where someone's like, she got a job because of tits, and then my report card. Like, just figure out a way to make that extra sassy. But I did get in trouble for writing too much sometimes. Like, even if they didn't have a word limit, I would write too much in school, and then they'd be like, this is 12 fucking pages. We don't have time for this. And one of the coolest things that I ever remember doing that I always try to tell teachers about because I loved it so much, and I feel like it just like inspired me as a writer. I don't remember what grade it was. We had a teacher who would play classical music and loop whatever song they were listening to and make us write what was happening. So just listen to the music and write down what you were hearing. And, you know, sometimes it was like a battle between elephants, and you just write what you were listening to. And I always really, really loved that. And I feel like that from a young age, having a teacher who was like, be creative, write whatever the hell you want, rather than be like, write a short story about this, I think really tapped into a creativity that was the thing that made me start writing outside of school too. So academically, I'm really bad at math. Like, just terrible. I've even thought about trying to find a way to get better at it, but I just have this, like, it's like I stare at numbers and my brain just, like, blank. Like, I can, you know, do basic maths, but really bad. There's got to be something about me that just, like, rejects the concept of numbers. So it's definitely a weak point. I also have, like, similar issues where, which I imagine is mathematically fueled. If you're editing a video and the audio is off sync, it takes me so much longer than it should to figure out if the audio is too far ahead or too far behind. Like, such a long time. My brain can't be like, oh, that's behind. Well, a lot of people can do that. I don't know what it is that, like, I just have this, I just can't comprehend it. I took a Mensa test for fun the other day, and on, like, the third question, I was like, no. Because I can't do maths. It's not for me. So terrible at maths, and I think that stopped me from pursuing a lot of sciences, which is a bummer because I actually do really like physics as a subject. I'm a little bit less interested in chemistry, but like now as I've gotten older, I find physics extremely interesting. So I always see it as like kind of a bummer that because I wasn't a maths kid, I didn't pursue physics because I guess I saw them as an overlap. And I think I had teachers tell me they were as well. You know, like, these, you're not going to be able to do that if you can't do this. Don't worry about it. So I largely did English-based subjects, and it's like kind of my regret. And one of the thing I feel passionately about is my issues with the education system. Because I was a great student. I got A's in everything. I won Ducks a number of times, which is basically just the top of your class in Australia. But that's only because I was doing the English-based subjects. So I basically just manipulated the system, and then I was like, I didn't even need to really research any of this or try very hard. I can just write a good essay. So you give me an A because it's written well, and thus is a convincing thing, but it could be in any subject. I could do that for ancient history. I could do it for legal studies. I could do it for English. So I feel like I figured out the one thing that I was good at and then cheated school and then didn't really take advantage of the things that I should have at school. And I think the fact that I was able to do that with someone like my sister, who is not as strong with literacy, couldn't do that, was like very obvious that they treat other kids like they were bad or not smart just because they didn't have some kind of like inherent skill that I had. And I've always like been very like against the education system because I was able to cheat it. I didn't have to show up. I didn't have to try very hard. And as a result of that, I don't think I was ever very inspired by school to try things that I should have been trying, which is the harder subjects, because all they care about is you getting an A, right? Hmm. So I was like, then I'll get the A's and I won't do anything else. And so I feel like I surely have just major gaps in my knowledge because I was like, I write a good essay, whatever, it's fine. Steve, this is really hard for me to not ask you questions back. I just want you to know that. This is very difficult for me. I keep being like, Steve, what were you like in school?
This is all about you, Alana.
Oh, I don't like it.
But onward we go. What was this like in college for you? Did you have that same system of figuring out how to do great?
Yes, but because I actually did learn so much in university, so I studied a Bachelor of Mass Communication majoring in Journalism and Entertainment. It was all stuff that was catered to writing. So aside from like marketing, which was a subject when I saw that I had to do marketing, I was like, are you shitting me? I don't want to do marketing. But then I did it and I was like, oh, this will help me as a journalist. Like the stuff that I learned from marketing was probably more helpful for me as a journalist than the journalism subjects. Because like you can kind of learn journalism without needing to go to school. I don't say that anyone who asks me, you know, I want to be in games media, I would recommend it for a certain set of skills, but you don't necessarily need it. All you really need to know when you're writing, especially something like games media, which is, you know, a different tier of journalism, is just have the most important information at the top. Don't talk about yourself. That's a common mistake people make. I'm very excited about the next Uncharted. Let's talk about, no, just the facts, get rid of it. But marketing, again, subject I didn't want to do. I also had a legal subject that I didn't want to do, but both of those was like, learning about marketing taught me so much about the approaches to marketing in the games industry, which I feel like helped my career so significantly. The legal stuff was the same. Like I still have a very base understanding of how a lot of law stuff works. Law stuff, she says. But I think that helped me too with like understanding how some of these AAA publishers function. So yeah, I didn't cheese my way through. I mean, I still got good grades, but I didn't cheese my way through university because there was a lot to learn. And I did learn a lot from it, even if a lot of those skills weren't necessarily necessary. And again, I don't always recommend that people feel like they need to go to university, because that's a big part of this issue I have with the education system, is I am a person who is well suited to that kind of academic learning. And there are a lot of people out there who are more creative writers who don't thrive in an environment that requires you to study and take tests and memorize, that I would hate to see those people be off put or feel like they don't belong in the industry because they aren't catered or they aren't strong where academic learning is concerned. So I'm glad that I went and I did learn a lot of stuff, but I don't think it's for everyone.
What college did you go to?
Queensland University of Technology, QUT.
Do they have a mascot?
No, we don't really do that in Australia. Like if we do have a mascot, I don't know what it is.
I imagine it's some sort of bee.
Let me look it up. QUT mascot. That would be cool. That'd be full circle. Okay, it's a purple cow.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's strange. But it seems like it might be a new thing. Purple cow is a city mascot and designed their businesses to stand out from the crowd through innovation in design, branding, packaging, market stall design. Wow.
You're welcome for the advertising, Queen's University. Do you think?
Yeah, Queensland's the states that I'm from, so it's Queensland University of Technology. I had a great time.
Do you think that the Queensland way prepared you for what the industry is really like?
Again, Steve, Queensland is Florida.
Well, you tell me, did you walk out of there going, all right, I'm going to be famous in video games, do-do-do-do-do.
Never an intent.
No.
Someone asked me about that the other day. They were like, when did you decide to be a public figure? This is not answer your question at all. But I didn't. There was no decision made. It just happened. I definitely didn't go, and today I will pursue fame. Definitely something that just happened and that I didn't expect for most of the time. Especially as a writer, with someone who was not trying to be a host, this isn't a thing that I asked for at all. And I remember having this day when I was maybe like 21, or I was having drinks with friends. Would have been 20, I guess, before I moved to the US. And I was like, I feel like I have a decision to make. I feel like I need to choose today if I should make all my accounts private and not let whatever this is going to do to my life happen, or if I should just let it happen. Because initially there was a lot of stuff that I didn't like about it and that I didn't want to deal with. And there's still a lot of stuff about it that I don't like where having followers is concerned. But I ended up being like, okay, well, today I will just pledge that I'm going to let it happen, but I'm going to make sure that I use it for good. And I feel like I've stuck to that. But in any case, to your question, did Queensland prepare me for the video game industry as a state? No. The University of Technology? No. I think that, again, I learned things that were valuable but not important. Like, I was writing as a freelancer while studying journalism at the same time, and I think I got much more experience. It was much more valuable from writing as a freelancer than I did from anything that I was really studying, because in a lot of cases, like, the tutors would be people who had just studied the same degree, but I had written more than them at a certain point. So yeah, it wasn't necessary, but I don't discount it entirely. I actually used my degree to get me to California. So I had to get like a certain score to be eligible to transfer to an American university. So I did that and then studied in the US for 6 months. And that was all basically just so that I could get to the American games industry, because I was already doing pretty well in Australia, you know, had established connections, was working regularly in the Australian games industry. But I was like, I would like to go further because there's very much a ceiling in the Australian industry for media, which is what I was doing at the time. I did that to get to California. I think like my first or second day, I met up with Max Scoville, who I don't know if he was working at IGN yet. He probably was. And that was like my attempt to not meeting up with Max. I've been a fan of Max and friends with Max for ages, but, you know, getting there at all was an attempt to try to see if A, I did want to work at a place like IGN or GameSpot. And if I did want to be in that part of the industry and if that's what I wanted to do, which I was pretty sure it was. And I applied for both in that 6 month period for jobs that they had. And I did get the job at IGN. I didn't get GameSpot because they couldn't afford my visa. They were like, we could maybe do this, but you would have to live in a different city, like pretty far away, and we can't pay for this. So that didn't go any further than that. But yeah, ended up working at IGN just like maybe 6 months after coming back to Australia. So that was a thing that I could not have done without university. It's a lot harder to make those connections internationally. I definitely had to try very hard to do that and was very specific about the university that I went to. I went to the San Jose State University, but that was because it was the closest to San Francisco, which is where I knew all those media outlets were. So definitely helped with that. There are things that it prepared me for. I think also just working with teams in university, I think probably helps a lot of people really significantly. You can't really get too arrogant in a lot of ways too. Like, that's an issue that you can see with a lot of people trying to break into games, is thinking they know better than everyone. I think university kind of batters it out of you a little bit. It's a common mistake new young people make. But I mean, I enjoyed it. Yeah. And also we don't have like insane debt in Australia, so that's a huge plus.
That's fair. Would you consider yourself a half full or a half empty kind of person?
I think I'm generally a half full. I think I'm generally pretty happy under virtually all circumstances. I'm generally pretty happy. But there are some things where if it's bad, I just go, this is fucked. And I'll just like throw my hands up and be like, it's done. Like, to bring a really petty one, if technology doesn't work, I'm not like, okay, here's how I fix this. I'll be like, fucking broken, I'm sick of this shit. Like, that's absolutely from my mom. She does the same thing. But I think generally I'd be a half full person for sure.
Do you feel like that upbringing is sort of what got you into having a passion for creativity in life? What do you feel like you really have a passion for other than just creating?
And think out of the box here. Like, the number one thing is writing, and I feel like I was almost born with that, but I don't know. It probably did come from my parents in some way. I definitely very passionately care about helping people. I'm currently mentoring 8 writers, which is a lot. And I'm probably not the best mentor, because it can be really hard to lock down a time to help them, but I, you know, do a lot of that stuff over text and just try to help people as much as I can. Obviously, very committed to doing charity work where possible. I do try to give people opportunities who wouldn't necessarily otherwise get them. So yeah, that is the thing that I would say drives me as a person is trying to help people, and I'm sure I made loads of mistakes along the way, but it is something that I try to do. And truthfully, that probably does come from my childhood. Me being 4 years younger than my sister, with the kind of circumstances we were growing up with, meant that I was the one looking after her because I didn't really understand what was happening. So I would say that's probably where that came from. It was like just being like the big sister, even though I was 4 years younger, just because I wasn't old enough to actually comprehend any of the situations that I was in. But yeah, I would say that's the out of the box passion. It's something that, like, I'm very empathetic, but I'm also not very emotional. So I care deeply about other people, but don't care that much about myself, I think, sometimes. Like, if any of my friends worked as hard as I do or the hours that I did, I'd be like, what are you doing? Please stop. But I'm like, I'm fine. What do you know? Which is definitely a thing that I've addressed. Yeah, I'm still passionate about a lot of the same stuff. Like, I still am just very into space. Like, any learning, I'm always very engaged in watching documentaries more than anything else, rather than watching kind of TV or film. Really like Batman. Really huge fan of Batman. That's a passion.
Well, let's dive into your work ethic there. Tell me a bit about your work ethic. You know, how hard do you think you work? How do you feel like you're doing as a person who has work ethic? And, you know, what do you think about the subject in general?
I am not equipped for every kind of workplace in that I do have health issues. I think that I've worked at places, probably like a limited amount of them, but some that find me probably very frustrating because sometimes I can't work. And I think that feeds into me working a shit ton when I do feel well enough to work. So I think that's where that really came from. For the periods of time where I can't work, I want to make up for it by overworking and doing as much as I can. And it's not, I was going to say it's not out of self-loathing, but some of it is in some cases where, like, having chronic illnesses is concerned for sure. Like, some of it's like I fucking hate myself, I'm useless. That's definitely a thing. When I was still in Australia, so maybe when I was like 19, I had realized at one point that I kept waking up and telling myself that I hated myself. I'd be like, you're a piece of shit. Why did you sleep for that long? You're an absolute piece of shit. And then I was like, I need to stop saying that to me. That's probably not good. But that definitely led to me wanting to overachieve when I can because I'm so excited to be able to. That's what I mean by not entirely out of self-loathing. I'm like, oh my God, I can do stuff. So for all the times where I just kind of can't do anything, or I have to go to a hospital, or I have to have, you know, more doctor's appointments than most people, certainly more than you, Steve. that's a big part of it for sure. But I think that working on the stuff that I get to work on, which is all very creative. So, you know, outside of my day job being a video game writer, which is inherently very creative, I'm all about like trying to find new mediums and ways to explore things, like new formats to do things. There was a period where I was on 6 podcasts, but each of them was very different to one another. So it's from a place of passion rather than from a place of work ethic. I definitely, even when I'm having health issues, will always get everything done on time. The problem is when you're asking me to be in an office, it can be tough, depending on where I'm at. Like, there was a period of time where I didn't upload a YouTube video for 3 months because I was like, I just can't manage having a job and doing this on the side. So that will happen every now and then. If I don't upload for a while, it's like, I'm not in a place where I can do it. But then when I can do it, I do so much of it. I definitely think it hurts my relationships. Overworking is, to talk about my actual work ethic again, that doesn't feel like the right word for me because it's not really ethic. It's just what I want to do. So I will generally work from 9 a.m. to probably 1 a.m. is what I would say is my average most days by choice. So like, people always ask, how do you manage having this day job at Sony and then also doing this stuff after hours? And to me, it's like, what do you mean? I just work the day job at Sony until 6 and then I do everything else. I don't understand what I just have 2 jobs. But I mean, you know this, there are days where I sometimes like I won't stream because I'm like, I'm just too tired today. There are days where I just can't, so I just don't do it. But for the most part, I just like actively engaging and creating stuff at all times, which, like I said, I think is to make up for the times where I can't. But yeah, it does cause issues with relationships. On weekends, I generally have to sleep for a very, very long time to get through my week. I usually will sleep for maybe like 15 hours a day. It means that I can't have a whole lot of a social life. It's definitely an issue in relationships. A, needing too much sleep, or B, working too much, where I do have to have partners call me out on it and be like, can we just have a day? Because otherwise, it's not that I don't like spending time with them. I will just keep working and be like, but we're in the same room. What do you, I don't, and that's definitely, it's definitely a thing that I have to be called out on. So I think in some cases it can make me kind of a shitty friend. And I did, when I was younger, try to hide that I had any problems from people. So then when I would like not be able to do something before 4 on a Saturday, they wouldn't know why. And it would just, I would just stop being invited to stuff. Now I've learned to be really explicit with my friends about it. So I'm like, you guys, I would love to do this thing. I don't know that I'm going to be able to on Saturday, so I will try. But if not, I will find a way to meet you guys after this thing, and that's how we'll make it work. And so now I figured out a balance to make that happen so I can still have a social life that doesn't exhaust me so much that I can't get through the rest of the week. But it doesn't, in theory, mean I'm prioritizing work over relationships. But I do think, yeah, being very explicit with people about what I need has helped me there a lot. It's just something I only figured out like in the last 4 years or so.
Do you feel like there is such a thing as working too much?
That's a tough question, Steve.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
It's a tough question because of the implications surrounding crunch in the games industry. What I will say is there is such a thing as working too much for someone else. If you are working too much for a company and they're taking advantage of you and telling you that, you know, even not telling you, just like creating a culture where you feel like you have to, I think that that is a problem. For me, working too much, I don't feel like exists unless I'm making myself sick with it, which I have also done before. Like in the periods where I feel healthy, I work too much and then I exhaust myself. That's definitely a thing. But for the most part, like this is what I want to do with my life. So like I'm much happier to work or create something than I am doing the stuff I feel like other people do, which is watch TV or film. Like that's really the exchange. It's like, it's just, we use the time differently. And I feel like that maybe my constant creative output is what makes me feel like I'm the positive person that I am. But I can definitely put too much pressure on myself, etc. But my general answer is no, unless it's for someone else or you aren't getting anything from it, then working too much is terrible.
Part of your working for yourself was when you made the decision to start vlogging as part of your career. When did you decide to start being a vlogger?
I started making YouTube videos, I think it was about a year after I started writing. And the decision to do that was that I just knew I want to work in the games industry. There are not that many jobs. I'm already writing as a freelancer. Even that sometimes, like, you know, paycheck to paycheck, hard to get work. The intent there was I was really bad on camera and I wanted to learn to get better at it because I recognized that a lot of these companies, which my gosh is still so true, were heading in the direction of video. So I was like, if I want to work in games media, even though I would still always choose to be a writer over a host, I am going to make sure that I am as employable as possible. So the intent with the YouTube channel was to get better at speaking on camera, get more comfortable with the idea of it. I deleted all my first videos because they were really bad, but it was still just like a fun, you know, experiment, and to learn to video edit and to learn like some basic production stuff, like how to light correctly, just really, really cool stuff like that. With, yeah, the sole intent was add this to my resume so that when I try to apply for one of these few full-time games writing positions that actually exist, I have the most experience possible, so that I won't get passed up. And I feel like it worked out pretty well. But that was the plan. And then my YouTube community has always grown really slowly, and I will always stand by that. It's such slow growth because of the way that I use it. I'm really inconsistent. I just make the stuff that I want to make. As it started to grow, I started to get this community where, to me, being in games media, but having a channel, I was like, oh, well, not many people, and it certainly applied to when I was doing it 10 years ago, there are not many people who get early access to things who are on YouTube individually as a platform. So, and this is a thing that I definitely still do. I was like, well, if I get these because I'm in games media and then I just make a video about it as well, then I'm giving this small audience that I have information that they wouldn't necessarily be able to get on the platform otherwise. So I'll just talk about video games. And that just continued to happen. So I have 550,000 subscribers, I think. And it did take a full decade, which I'm not going to say it's a tiny amount, but to me, it's like so tiny in the grand scheme of things. I'd be very happy if it didn't grow any further. That's not to say that like I don't love the community that I do have. I think my YouTube community is wonderful, especially compared to some of the websites that I've worked for. But growth is not my intent at all there. And I almost wear that slow growth as like a badge of honor. I've always just made the stuff that I want to make. And I know that a lot of the stuff that I post won't necessarily get many views. And I generally know what will get views, but I won't do it. And I think it's just like a place where, yeah, because it grew out of me just wanting to be more experienced and then became, well, now I'm just going to share stuff that I feel really positively about. I certainly have people criticize me for doing unboxings, but the reason that I will always do them, and I guess that's because they consider it to be like base level content. The reason I will consistently do them is because I love toys. So if I'm opening something, I'm always very excited. And I'm like, if I'm excited, then why not share the being excited? Why not just share the positive thing? Even if it's considered trash content, I'm going to do it because I'm really happy. So that's the balance that I've struck. And I think is why I have a very positive relationship with YouTube, that I don't have the kind of content creator crunch, is because if I can't make a video in a week, I just won't make it. And I will make the stuff that I like and the stuff that I enjoy rather than trying to use it as a job, which is obviously I'm in a tremendous position of privilege to be able to do that. But it means I have a lot of fun on that platform. But yeah, it ultimately just came from wanting more experience. That's it.
Do you feel like vlogging in general is very taxing? Does it take a lot out of you?
No, because I have that relationship with it where I'll only do it if I find it fun. If I have ever made stuff that has been because I felt like I had to or something like that, I'm sure I would find that taxing. But because I am doing it by choice always, and I can skip it whenever I want to, I don't have to post stuff, then no. So like the one thing that I have that I do find taxing is Play Watch Listen, the podcast that I do with Austin Wintery, Troy Baker, and Mike Bithell. If I have to edit that podcast, I'm like, fuck this podcast. Like, I love doing that show, but if I have to edit it, which I do this week because the editor is sick, that becomes taxing because I don't want to do that. There's a lot of videos that I really like editing and I have fun editing gameplay videos. Even unboxings, I can have fun editing them, but the podcast, I hate it because it's not creative. There are no creative cuts. There's no like, ooh, if I zoom in here, this joke is funnier. If I cut this audio here, this like narrative bit is better. The podcast is just make sure everyone's audio is roughly the same. I hate it. So that's taxing because it's not something I want to do. The one thing I will say is like, so a vlog I see as like a specific kind of content, which is generally like a handheld, hey, I'm going to do this today, come with me. I don't do very much of that, but I do intend to do one for traveling during the pandemic because I'm going home. Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to try and film that just to show people kind of what it's like for anyone who's not been traveling. And that stuff is taxing to me because you unintentionally automatically make yourself the center of attention. So if you're in an airport and you have a camera and you're saying something to it, everyone is going to look at you. And I hate that. I'm like, but how do I tell the story unless I'm actively telling the story? So that's the thing that I'm like, there is a probably 50% chance that I will bail out of that because I'm too uncomfortable with actual vlogging being like speaking to the camera in public while walking or whatever. That we'll see. I'll see if I can do it. I might be too uncomfortable. I don't know. But yeah, no, generally I don't find that stuff taxing. That the only content creation thing I find really taxing, again, outside of editing the podcast, is any long stream. I've done like 8-hour, 9-hour streams for charity before, even did one 24-hour one for Funhouse, and I don't know how people stream for a long time. I think you stream for longer than I do. I'm like, I just get so tired. I'm just like, fuck, just let me, I don't want to sit here and talk anymore. How long do you stream for?
That's a question. On average. You're not allowed to ask questions.
Damn it, sorry. Steve.
Sorry, it's against the rules. But what you can do is you can tell me, where do you keep up that kind of mental energy? Where do you find it? What is your center of your source of mental energy and power?
I'm very introverted. So, you know, I'm doing this podcast with you. And then I'm going to stream Pokemon Snap tonight. And then I'm going to see friends. So today is going to tire me, because it's a lot of talking to people. And that means that tomorrow, when I have 3 videos I intend to make and schedule, that will like reinvigorate me because I'm doing that alone. So it's not like I don't love talking to you, Steve. You know I love talking to you.
Crushed.
But yeah, being a little bit too social, or like streams feel a little bit social. YouTube videos, even though you could argue they're social because you're making them for people, when I'm making them, it's just me in my apartment alone. You know, yeah. Like I don't feel like that's social in the slightest. Actually gives me mental energy, I think. So I kind of need to like have those like, okay, I'm privately working on this thing in my apartment. There's nobody here. There's no noise. I will make this. That, yeah, that's where the mental energy actually comes from, to work on the stuff. If I had to be social 24/7, I would be a mess. That would be where I would fail.
Do you think?
And I don't.
Do you think that's your key? Is that the recharging, the balance between having time up and time down?
Could be. I mean, like, even meetings, I can get tired of the social stuff. Like, even business meetings, I can be like, okay, well, I spoke to 4 humans today and I need to check out. No, I would say, like, the big key probably, I think, like, if you were to psychoanalyze me, would come from the periods where I can't do anything. That really is what it is like that I have all these, like, I've been actually very good for the last year because I've been working from home. But if I have any illnesses that prevent me from working, the energy comes from the times where I can. It's like, well, I need to take advantage of this time because I can do it right now. So I'm going to do all of it. And I'm very excited about it. I think that's where it comes from. I think that if I didn't have any of those kind of extremes, then I probably wouldn't have the energy to make stuff. But yeah, it also just doesn't feel draining to me. Like I said, a stream can. Talking to people too much can, but making content or like writing or making YouTube videos, none of that is, it just doesn't feel like work. And again, probably because I don't have to do it. It's a choice where, like, yeah, I can't watch TV for too long without like just feeling like I'm wasting my time and being very bored. And that's what people seem to tell me to do more often. It's like, why don't you just sit on the couch and not do anything? Like, but then I just feel like shitty. Like I don't know. It doesn't work. Obviously, I play a lot of video games too. But yeah, I mean, that still ties into work. But that is also like a very good downtime for me. It's like I just play a lot of video games and that I can allow myself to do because it feels productive, but it's still ultimately not actually that productive.
Do you feel like what you do is a balance between persona and who you really are? If you had to sort of put that in perspective as to the real Alana and on-screen Alana, where would you put that?
I think I'm pretty much the same. Yeah, I don't think I change really at all. I think I'm in person. I'm pretty mean, I would say. Like, I mean, you know this. That's a thing that I don't necessarily do on the internet all the time. But, like, I'm very mean to my friends. And that you would see more in person than you would see on the internet. And my friends are very mean to me. I don't know if that's an Australian thing or whatever, but I have always found that fun. So that's probably the only thing that, like, but I still do it. Like, Brian from Game Informer tweeted a pun the other day, and I just replied with, fuck you, Brian. And I think most people, like, sometimes they read that stuff, are like, oh my God. Like, I've had that with you. I'll just, like, insult you, and people are like, what? And that's the thing that I know I can't do too much of on the internet. Yeah. Is like tell my friends to go fuck themselves, but in person I'll do that all the time. But otherwise, I don't think I have a persona or a balancing act at all. I think I'm pretty much the same.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
I mean, let's talk about success. You know, you have nearly 500,000 followers on Twitter, on YouTube. By any measurement, that's success by social media standards. Do you feel like you've been successful with social media?
I don't think about that. So I took a personality test the other day that, like, I had the same problem. I was like, what do you mean by success?
Wait till you hear the next question.
Shit. Do I feel like I've been successful with social media? It's definitely not something that I feel like I pay any attention to other than what I can do with it when it comes to things like raising money for charity. I don't really think about it, but I make money from an Instagram post now. So of course, and that stuff is tremendously helpful for a bunch of reasons, for things that I can fund, you know, like the reason that I can really float the podcast expenses, which, you know, is free. We don't make much money off the ads. It's like negligible. It's in the negative, but I can do that because of taking a sponsorship on a YouTube video elsewhere. So financially, for sure, video game writing doesn't pay that much. And you know, I am still on the road to saving to eventually buy a house that I started when I was 17. So this can certainly help with that stuff. And I'm also very aware that it will disappear eventually. I don't think that social media following's lost for most people. Like, at some point, eventually, people will stop engaging to the extent that they do with the stuff that I post right now. So my thought is, well, if I can do anything with that now, especially to balance out the shit that comes with social media, and I'll buy myself a house and I will not spend all of the money that I make from this, which I do still do probably more than I should. Yeah, successful. I mean, sure. Like, I'm able to accomplish things that I wouldn't be able to otherwise where a lot of the charity work that I do is concerned. I can help people. I can help smaller content creators that I really believe in to, like, get a larger following by using mine. But I also, compared to so many of my friends, am like the tiniest and have the smallest engagement. So I don't feel like it's like I'm huge, but I do have influence that I think that I can successfully use for good. So yes, it's successful, but it's also not something that I ever try to do. I'm not like, when I write a stupid joke tweet, I'm not like, this one's going to get me followers. Like, I don't think about it that way. It's not something I tend to focus on a lot, is what I would say.
Do you think it's healthy to be on social media?
I think I have a healthy relationship with social media, but in general, I would say no. I think it is absolutely destroying us and we don't know what to do with it. If you want more spicy takes, education, social media. The problems with social media is like, you know how people say one day the robots are going to control us? They already are. We're just feeding data centers. We're responding to an algorithm that is designed by a robot to hit a button, to give it feedback, to push more shit on the algorithm so that it can sell you stuff. Like, we are already catering to robots. And I mean, part of the issue with Twitter and YouTube specifically, which is why the app that I actually do spend the most time on is Instagram, which, by the way, Steve, I'm not following you because you don't post enough. I just wanted you to know that. You need to up your Instagram game.
It's killing me, okay? Not being able to answer you. Damn it. Steal the question. Steal the question, damn you. Can't wait for this to go up. Steve yells at guests. First guest. I'm on a fierce good sale that by
harassed
Steve.
off of podcast.
I'm very good at this, people. Very good. Anyway.
I think that on Twitter and YouTube, the way that algorithm works encourages people to be vitriolic and hateful and have a take that they don't necessarily have in the real world and to lose nuance and to be as aggressive as possible. I'm not saying that I'm immune to that. I think that applies to virtually everyone. And I think that that is a huge problem. And I have this thing with people who are very close to me. Like, we said this before we started. I'm like, you just need to log off. You really just need to not use Twitter for a bit. And I feel like I use Twitter for maybe 5 minutes a day. It's not very much. It's very limited interactions, but I will more if I'm like not doing anything interesting and I'm like, sure, whatever, I'll like read my timeline. But I don't tend to like spend very much time on there or read very much on there. Where I have friends who will come to me and be like, people are saying this, this is so ridiculous. And I'll be like, are people saying that or is Twitter saying that? Is this reflective of the real world or is this Twitter? Because this is a specific culture that I don't think this one person that you spoke to on Twitter, which is only 20% of the US is even on Twitter, and of that, only 1.5% actually frequently tweet. It's not a lot of people. If you walk out on the street and you tell a random person what you just read on Twitter, will they agree with it? Probably not. And that's not to say that Twitter can't be used for good. For both you and I, it's tremendously helpful for advocacy, for raising money, for a lot of things. But I think generally, the culture is vitriolic and angry, and the idea of cancel culture, I don't think is something that is new or is liberal, or I don't think it applies to either political party or any political party. It's just human nature, is that we really like to throw stones at someone when they do something wrong, or publicly hang is something that we used to do. We're now just doing it on Twitter in front of hundreds of thousands of people. That's the problem with it. It's like, this is a human nature and an extension of that human nature, but what we're doing with it here, we are not mentally equipped to deal with. We do not know how to cope with this. And I feel like social media has progressed beyond us in a way that we aren't aware of what we're doing to ourselves. And we're going to find out eventually, and it's going to be bad. Like, I don't feel good about it. I think my advice for virtually anyone for social media is like I know people who, for some business reasons, I can understand it. And of course, like, it's easy for me to say in the position that I'm in, but like, people who obsess over the amount of likes that they have, like, I've never looked. I never am like, how many likes did I get on this? Oh, this person didn't like this. Like, why the fuck would I care about that? And again, I get it's easy for me to say with the 500,000 followers or whatever, but for the most part, I always just want to be like, none of this matters. It matters insofar as you can like mess up relationships and it can be utilized to help you professionally. But like, getting anxious about these tiny things on these apps, I'm just like, I just feel like it's probably not for the best overall.
Do you feel like you can use social media without it hurting you?
Yeah, I'm fine. But that's only because I'm so filtered. So like, I don't see anything really. I will have other people tell me about the stuff that's happened on Twitter in a day. And they're like, did you see this? And I generally have no idea. The only time I ever cause a problem is when I do it myself, which is when I'm curious and I like go read my quote tweets. I don't read my replies very often. I'll only really see a reply if someone else I'm following has interacted with their reply. So I don't see most of that, but sometimes I'll like, what do the quote tweets say? I'm in an Uber. Take a look. And the other day it was like some dude trying to cancel me because I said that there weren't many next-gen consoles. He told me that I was privileged and it meant that I wanted people to die of COVID. My tweet was, we still can't get these consoles, huh?
Mm-hmm.
He was very upset. Man, I was like, are you... What? No. But it's my own fault for looking. I should know that Twitter, like, does that. You know, that's people get really offended by things because that's what suits the algorithm. And it's also for a lot of these people, I think, just an outlet. You know, if you're frustrated at things in the real world that you feel like you can't control, you feel like you can control the internet because you're controlling what you're putting on your timeline. So I recognize that too, and am in a lot of cases okay with being somebody's punching bag if they need it. I just won't look at it, and that's okay.
How do you feel like your lens, as you called it, affects how you view social media and really the world with, you know, Brie Larson being someone who answers to you and these amazing friends that you have that I could name all day, you know, but are arguably numbers-wise, statistically, quote-unquote, larger than you, and yet you are undoubtedly still high up in the percentage yourself. How does that feel to be able to kind of see both sides of that lens?
I try not to think about it, Steve. You're making me think about it.
It's the point of the podcast, a lot, is to make you think.
I think one thing that's very helpful, you know, Ethan Nestor is one of my best friends. It's Crank Gameplays. He has a million followers. You could argue that that's just double my amount, but it's not. Like, Ethan's followers are like, wow, very intense and about Ethan in a way that's really interesting. And people like you, people like Zombie, I find it comforting to have friends who have like different varying levels of followers and friends who aren't on social media at all, just because then we get to have conversations about it. It's like a very fun coping mechanism. Like, it's a good way to talk to people. With Ethan, to sometimes get like the stuff he deals with puts into perspective what I deal with. I'm like, oh, that's wow. I don't deal with that. Like, it's definitely a scale for everyone. And I just think having like people with varying levels of followings or whatever is a convenient way to talk about it. But I also, being a person who tries not to pay attention to however many likes I have, I don't do things for followers. I don't feel like I cater anything to that. I'm sure I probably do subconsciously, but generally, like, I've spoken to you about this. One of the like most first world problem struggles that I have is feeling like I'm harassed for being attractive. And that's like a thing that I'm still trying to come to terms with, is I'm allowed to be feminine and be in the space. Like, I'm allowed to look like a woman and exist in video games. And I have to stop telling or stop letting these people tell me that the minute that I have any cleavage visible, because that is just actually how I dress in the real world, that I'm a whore and I don't deserve my job. I have to stop listening to them, because I think one day I'll be like, why did I let them harass me? It doesn't make any sense. It's so stupid. And that's a thing that, like, obviously I do pay attention to that. And I make sure that on streams, I am virtually always wearing a t-shirt and a hoodie, which is not reflective of how I would dress in the real world. So mostly wear a singlet or whatever, though. That's a thing that, like, I'm sure I pay attention to. But when it comes to people who have more followers than me, it's not something I think about. I don't think about, and I'm not sure what it is about me that's like, I don't care about celebrities really at all. So like, my brain doesn't go, oh my God, Brie Larson. My brain goes, oh, will this help Able Gamers? I don't think about it as, oh, the celebrity spoke to me. And I don't care about seeing celebrities in person. I just don't think about those things that way. And I don't really know how to articulate why, because I've not thought about why. But I know that it's a thing that people make fun of me for. Like, you see an actor, I'm like, cool, that's chill. I'm indifferent to this. And I, like, Brie Larson, I almost felt bad. Like, I was just like, oh, I feel like I harassed somebody. I feel like what happened with her responding there was that my followers went after her because I was trying to get her to help out with, like, join a stream, because obviously you have a celebrity, you raise so much more money for charity. And then that not happening and her releasing a video felt like she had to do it. And I was like, now I just feel sort of shitty. I wasn't like, oh, Brie Larson. I was like, oh no, will it help? And also, did I make someone uncomfortable? So yeah, the answer to your question, I think, if I've read it correctly, is I don't feel like I pay a lot of attention to how many followers other people have either, as I don't try to pay attention to it for myself, other than as an outlet to talk to people about the unique things that come with being any kind of public figure or the pressures. Like, you specifically have been so helpful with me having an outlet to talk to someone about that kind of stuff. And that's something that is like a unique position that not everyone can understand, I guess.
Well, I think that we would be remiss if we didn't wrap up talking to Alana Pierce by asking the parody of the 10 questions that that James Lipton would ask on Inside the Actors Studio. I'm going to ask you some rapid-fire questions now. And they're going to ramp from not serious to serious. Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready. Let's go.
Okay, favorite color?
Purple.
Least favorite?
Orange.
What's the best thing you've ever tasted?
Sausage roll.
What's the worst?
Celery.
Have you ever loved?
Yes.
Have you ever hurt someone?
Yes.
What is it that someone can do to earn your trust?
Be dependable and consistent. I don't think that I'm very trusting overall.
What is it that someone can do to lose your trust?
Lie to me repeatedly. People do it all the time. I'm very good at figuring out when people are lying. And they just do it over and over and over again. I'm like, why do you think I don't know? What are you doing?
If someone spoke to you the way that you speak to yourself when no one else is around, would you be friends with that person?
Depends on the day, Steve. Sometimes I'm very mean to myself, but sometimes I do my makeup well, and I've tried to start doing a better job of highlighting it if I feel like I look pretty, because that's something that like I've tied to shame in a stupid way, and I'll be like, I think I look nice, so I've tried to get better about that.
If you died tomorrow, what do you hope that people remember you for?
I can say what I think people would remember me for. What do I hope people would remember me for?
What do you hope?
I would hope that people would be able to take some kind of lesson helping people. I would think that, like, no matter what position you're in, that you should try to help others and try to be a better person. I don't know that they would take that, but that's what I would hope.
The big question. Do you have a personal life philosophy that you would attribute to getting where you are right now?
Yeah, it's just... This is such a shitty answer to a sweet question. It's just do stuff. Whatever I want to accomplish, I look at what I think I need to do that. Like I said, the reason that I started making YouTube videos was to stack out my portfolio to make sure I was employable. So it's just do the thing. Don't stress about the thing. Obviously, if people have anxiety, that's like a very complicated thing to say. Much easier said than done for a lot of people. But just keep doing stuff and like figure out what it is that you're trying to accomplish and the steps that you've seen other people take to try to accomplish that and what a resume might ask for any given thing. That's always my advice for people making YouTube videos or wanting to start on Twitch is like, just do it. Don't worry about what other people think. Have a good time. Just start doing stuff. So that I would say is a life philosophy that's led to where I am today, for sure.
Do you think some things are better left unsaid?
Yeah, but I'm bad at that. I say all the things even when I'm like, probably didn't need to tell them that.
And with that, Alana Pierce, thank you for being the first guest on Hi, My Name is Steve.
Thank you, Steve. This made me really uncomfortable. I had a great time and you're a great interviewer. But what if we spoke more about Steve next time? It feels like it's Hi, My Name is Alana, Steve. Okay?